This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today's conversation is about something that is hanging over all of us this morning. The grand jury decision we heard last night that there will be no indictment of the Ferguson, Missouri police officer for killing unarmed teen Michael Brown. The community there erupted in violence after the prosecuting attorney in the case took hour upon hour building tension for the decision, which he read to a national audience, taking great pains to blame the media for stoking the flames. Minutes later, President Obama addressed the nation.
We need to recognize that this is not just an issue for Ferguson. This is an issue for America. We have made enormous progress in race relations over the course for the past several decades. I have witnessed that in my own life, and to deny that progress, I think, is to deny America's capacity for change. But what is also true is that there are still problems, and communities of color aren't just making these problems up.
Brown's death has been followed by several other high-profile cases of young African Americans being shot by police. It's sadly not an unusual story. ProPublica reports that young black males in recent years are at far greater risk of being shot dead by police than their white counterparts. 21 times greater, in fact, according to this analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings. Of course, if we just focus on young African Americans who are killed by police, or just on the police response to African American protesters, we're missing a whole series of important systemic issues. The revolving door of incarceration for young men of color, the pervasive racial profiling that has its own name, driving while black, and the sense that in both urban and suburban America, this trend isn't getting better, despite both the president and top justice official who are African American. Today, we're going to listen to a panel conversation we taped last week in advance of this news. It was sponsored by the Center for Africana Studies at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain. Our guests were Timothy Black, a sociology professor at Case Western Reserve University and author of On Becoming a Teen Mom, Life Before Pregnancy. Also, Larice Harvey, director of strategic relations at A Better Way Foundation. Community activist Agnes Kurzina. Roderick Anderson, a PhD candidate in anthropology at UMass Amherst, and Shavik Abdusaber, New Haven police officer and author of A Black Man's Guide to Law Enforcement in America.
And I'll ask you first, Roderick, if you would, to weigh in on what we should be talking about right now. Like, what's the conversation that we should be having right now as we all wait in fear of what this grand jury in this one town and this one place in America is going to do?
An important aspect that we should be focusing on is to remember that this is part of a historical trend in America. You know, if you really want to understand how to move forward, we have to put it in this historical context, right? You know, the African-American experience has been one of experiencing extreme violence in this country, you know, be it captivity, slavery here in the U.S., you know, looking at the Jim Crow laws coming out of the Civil War, looking at the burning down of black towns all across the country, historically black towns that were in existence, the historical disenfranchisement that's occurred in this country amongst African Americans. You have the revolts in the 50s and 60s, you know, within the African American communities, all against police violence. You know, the vast majority of the revolts, you know, in the civil rights era, you know, were because of police violence, right? So this is the historical trend. So if we really want to try and come up with a way to address these problems, we have to look at the fact that it's been systemic and historical, right? And come up with actual policies that can fundamentally change the way in which the police act as overseers within the African American communities, right? And one aspect of that, and I'm also ex-military, you know, vet, the U.S. Air Force Security Forces out of Westover, working with a lot of law enforcement from New England area, looking at there needs to be an accountability with them, right? There's this aspect of policing that a lot of officers tend to place themselves above everyone else. You know, you get this trend also with guys in the military as well, you know, with their attitudes towards civilians and civilians being beneath them. Right, and you place those types of individuals in positions of authority, especially in historically black or Latino or minority communities, you know, you're going to end up with things such as Ferguson, right? You're going to see rampant stop and frisk, you know, as we saw in the case in New York, and how that was just legislated into law.
Yeah. Larice Harvey, I'd like you to pick up on this and maybe tell me what you think we should be talking about as we talk so much about Ferguson and the aftermath right now in America. What is it we're not talking about that we should be?
I agree with Roderick, because what we're not talking about is the historical content of what's happening in this time. And we're not rallying. We're still being apathetic about, okay, well, you know, they're animals anyway. We're not talking about our own subliminal messages that we get through the media, that we get through, you know, the TV shows we watch. We have our own biases. When we watch somebody's Facebook page, when we're looking at a video on YouTube, we have our own biases that we have created, that we are afraid of the black man. And that's the conversation we need to have, is about how do we stop being afraid of the black man? How do we stop being afraid of the black woman? How do we stop being afraid of the Latino man? How do we stop being afraid of the Latino woman? How do we embrace our humanism as a unit and move forward? And that's the conversation we're not having, because nobody wants to talk about the big elephant in the room, racism.
Aggie, how about you?
We need to start looking at how this ties back to, when does this start for children? People in general. And it's really these days starting in school, unfortunately. With a lot of the ed reform that's going on, a lot of zero tolerance policies are being implemented in schools, mostly urban district schools. So you won't see these zero tolerance policies in a Plainville or a Glastonbury, but you will see these zero tolerance policies in New Britain, Hartford, New Haven, etc. And they're starting to, they suspend kids in kindergarten, okay? And they're suspending black and brown kids in kindergarten. They're not suspending other kids in kindergarten. I also run a program at my place of employment. I work at an insurance company in Hartford, and we mentor students from Freddie Wish School, which is in the north end of Hartford. We bus them over once a week and spend an hour with them, mentoring them, doing their homework. And I've been doing this for 5 years now, running the program. Over the last couple of years, it's been alarming how this selective, just within our little group of 25, 27 students, how many of them, and these are ages, this elementary school, ages third grade through eighth grade, are getting suspended. Mm-hmm. I had a student last year, he was but 90 pounds soaking wet, and got in third grade suspended 3 times out of school suspension. Why is that happening? Who thinks that that's a good idea? How is that going to help that child?
Well, no, that's preparing them for prison.
I think it's been said. I'll say it a little differently, but I think it's been said. I think about these things. I think we have to look at the era we're living in. And when I think about that, I think about, you know, the intersection of economic capitalism and white supremacy. And we need that framework in order to talk about policing and talk about the prison, the school to prison pipeline, and so on. You know, we have a population in black and brown ghettos who are, you know, isolated and excluded and basically are economically obsolete. We have millions of people in our country who have no place. And in my view, what we have done as in response to that, there's a number of ways you can respond to that. Right, but the ways in which we have responded to that is to create institutions to control that population, and those institutions include the kind of warehousing schools that was just being talked about. It includes the police. That is the role of the police. It's a very difficult position to put police officers in. I mean, let's talk about it in those terms. Like, what's their job? To subdue and control and manage a population. We have 2.3 million people in prison. We have over 7 million whose lives are being managed by the criminal justice system, either through parole, probation, or being in jails or in prisons. That's 1 in 32 adults and 1 in 3 black men whose lives are being managed by the criminal justice system. Now, the only way we can understand that is to understand that in this context of the current era or period of economic capitalism and white supremacy, racial domination. That's what we're talking about. And so when Ferguson is everywhere. You know, and the interesting thing about Ferguson, which Roderick said, is of course it's an inner ring suburb. So we see that these problems are not just in the cities now, but they're also in, they're in black suburbs as well, as urban sprawl has created the same. I mean, in 1968, there were no black people living in Ferguson. Right, the first black person moved into Ferguson, and that's a very interesting story. I won't get off on that right now, but I mean the drama in just trying to move into this white suburb during this period of time. Well, because of, as Larice said, housing policies, because of real estate practices, finance, housing policies, federal government urban renewal policies, and so on, we end up with Ferguson. And we again we have this situation where you have police officers and school officials and state social welfare workers and so on, whose job is to contain and manage the lives of this population.
So, Shafiq Abdusaburt, you're the policeman on the panel. I guess I'm wondering, first of all, if you might give me your sense of what you think we should be talking about right now, and also maybe a little bit of a response to what Tim just said. Police in America, especially in urban areas, are put in a very difficult position because they're being asked to do something that is incredibly not only hard to do, but in many ways not the right thing to do for the way we probably need to get past some of these issues.
So if I can answer the last question first. You know, I believe that where we are in America right now, anybody that has a profession is in a tough position to do their job. That's a fact. There's no way in the world that you can work in America in this day and time and not be confronted with cultural challenges from the population you serve, confronted with mental health challenges from the population you serve, sexual or gender issues with the population you serve, and certainly financial, educational, and economic challenges. Now, most professions are not trained to deal with all of those things. They have one specific job or role. But our population, our society, is dictating to us otherwise. So now, as Americans in our profession, we're stuck. Do I just do my job and go home, or do I try to take on this other part of what's going on with my profession? And it doesn't matter if you're the cashier at Walmart. You're still going to be confronted with that population that comes through with their issues on every level. So I would say that we're all in school right now to try to handle this social, cultural, economic dilemma in a fast-paced, growing, capitalistic society. America right now is the oldest capitalistic society, right? We are the oldest. So we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow because no other society in history has ever made it past this point. But America is, I think this year, 286 years old. So we are a young Western society in a very old world, right? So in that sense, I would say when you are given those duties, and whether it's you're a police officer or a brain surgeon or a veterinarian or whatever it is that you do, I think everyone is struggling with doing their job, maintaining the mission statement and the goals and objective of their job, but at the same time, trying to help a very difficult society through their moments, too.
But is the job that urban police officers are given, is it the job that, frankly, they should be doing? I mean, are you tasked in American cities right now with the right work?
I think officers have a lot on their plate.
Yep.
You know, officers right now are social workers, you know, they're mental health folks, you know, they're everything, you know, because when you respond to someone's house or an incident, your job is to try to fix that. You're trying to fix their problem. You're trying to fix a community problem, and that takes a lot. And that's going to require more training. And so, you know, a lot of the training you get outside of what you're going to get, you know, through the department, you also have to then figure out, where can you go get more training? Do you need to go to school? Do you need to read certain books? Do you need to watch certain documentaries so that you can keep up on the current affairs? Because, you know, you know as a sociologist that, you know, policing is based on social science. And social science is based on the study of people, anthropology. And people are constantly evolving. So if you're a psychologist, what work, the therapy that worked this year may not work on next year's generation or the next week's generation. And it's the same thing. The technique that you might use today as an officer to apply to quell a situation, that may not work tomorrow.
So, quickly, I'll just ask you, Tim Black, to pick up on this. I think part of the issue is that police in America do have a tough job. I ask Shafiq, you know, are they given the right job to do? Does a lot of this have to do with just the way that we ask people to control communities that are, in many cases, disadvantaged, that have all the problems that we've already laid out? I mean, does it really have to start kind of at the top about the way we think about policing? Is it the individuals on the ground? I mean, what is it that you think is the root cause of the problem, Tim?
Well, by saying that it's a difficult job to do when you have to manage the lives or suppress a population doesn't let them off the hook, right? I mean, there's lots of different ways to do that. And, you know, the federal government has going back to the point you made earlier, John, you know, the federal government has militarized these local police forces. They've provided incentives for them to confiscate property, financial incentives. I mean, so we have a set of policies that have shaped policing in these communities, and then you have police forces that have, you know, there's police forces vary, and there's different ways of doing policing, and there's different strategies for doing policing. You know, for instance, anyone who's taught in one of these warehouse schools, for instance, in New York or in Hartford or anywhere, where the intention is anything but education, it's about being able to maintain a population in a given space. And hold them there and warehouse them there. Anyone will tell you, anyone who's taught in those schools will tell you that the only way that you can teach in those schools is you have to learn to deal with violence in a very calm. You have to learn to deactivate it. You have to learn. So there are different strategies, and there are some strategies that are better in those situations, whether it's policing or whether it's in the schools, when you're confronting violence. So I'm not letting anyone off the hook. What I am trying to do, though, is to point out that there are certain structural dynamics here in which we're asking prison guards to do the same thing. We're asking prison guards to manage the lives of 2.2 million people.
You're listening to a panel conversation on policing the black community at Central Connecticut State University. Our panelists are Timothy Black, a sociology professor at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Larice Harvey, a director of strategic relations at A Better Way Foundation, community activist Agnes Kurzina, Roderick Anderson, who is a PhD candidate in anthropology at UMass Amherst, and author and police officer Shafiq Abdusabur. More after this break. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're listening back to a panel discussion we hosted at Central Connecticut State University called Policing the Black Community. Our panelists were Case Western Reserve University sociology professor Tim Black, community activist Agnes Kurzina, Roderick Anderson, a PhD candidate at UMass Amherst, author and police officer Shafiq Abdusabur, and here's Larice Harvey, director of strategic relations at A Better Way Foundation. I asked her about how we get police to act differently toward African Americans.
We need to reshape the mindset of everyone, not just the police, but the people outside of the police who are telling the police, you got the right to do that to protect my liberties, as if black males and Latino males have no liberties and are not human beings. And if we really want to talk and have a real conversation about this, we have to go all the way back to the 13th Amendment. Slavery is still intact in America, and it's called except if you are convicted and incarcerated. And so when you start thinking about who's getting arrested, who's in our prison system, you know, and we think about, you know, I do drug policy reform. And so when we talk about drug-free school zones, nice catchphrase, like, yeah, we want our schools to be drug-free. Guess what? It is one of those policies that the police use to incarcerate hand over fist a lot of blacks and Latinos in those poor neighborhoods. And so as long as we accept those kind of policies under the guise of protecting our children, whose children are we really protecting when 68% of drug use is white males and 68% of overdose in Connecticut are young white males from the ages of 15 to 25? So when we're having this conversation about how do we work with the police, how about the police stop attacking us and work with us and stop telling us what the law says and be a human being in a situation, not escalate a situation because of your own internal biases, but de-escalate a situation. And you're right, we do need training, but who's doing the training? Military to the police? Social workers to the police? Who's gonna do the training to the police that the police here understand is going to obey? Because obviously it's not the community, it's not the experts, it's not the policy, although they rely on the policy, it's really reshaping the mindset. How do we shift the consciousness of how we do social control? How do we shift the consciousness of how we deal with one another, even when we're policing each other? Because the police got a police, but do they actually do their job?
Shafiq, do you have a response to what Larice just said?
So I would agree with some of what you say. And one of the problems we're having in America right now, and it's a real problem, is that a lot of these young black men don't have fathers. A lot of these young black men have to rely potentially on a mentor, whether it's a police officer or anybody, to help guide them through that next step. I have three sons, and as they've gotten older, that 14, 15, 16 is really tough to try to mold them into the point of where they understand respecting people, respecting authority, being respectful, and knowing how to conduct themselves, not just with the police, but with anybody. And what we're finding, at least what I'm finding, is that what we have in America right now, we have, unfortunately, a lot of young black men from single-parent families where there's no father involved, and they've gone beyond that threshold, and a lot of times they're right at that 15, 16, 17, and there's no one there to really polish them off on the edge. And so therefore, when they're engaging a police officer, which a police officer often is going to be when they engage, it's going to be authority. And that's where you have that bad reaction.
So who wants to jump in? I'm going to ask Aggie to jump in first.
I think I take issue with what you just said, because you're buying into the fact that a couple of things. One is that there's a lot of absent fathers in the black and brown community.
That's a fact.
Is not necessarily true. The absenteeism is a result of the fact that their fathers are being policed and put in jail, and or because of poverty and drug issues. That's really the main reasons why fathers may not be as present. But there's also issues in the white community as well that just are not talked about with regards to parenting. The other thing is that there are many more opportunities for those white people than there are for minorities to be able to get a good job and be a productive member of society and be a cohesive family, because you're constantly being marginalized to where you can't on paper show that you're a family for whatever reasons, for whatever benefits you might need to get or what have you. And those are the things that are tearing the families apart in the minority community.
Yeah, the issue of single family households is completely different and separated from how you interact with law enforcement officers, right? Because as we saw in the case with Trayvon Martin, he was walking home to from the store with some Skittles and a juice and minding his own business, and he was attacked by Zimmerman.
Zimmerman was not a police officer.
Yeah, I know he was, but I'm just using that as an example.
Well, that's a bad example.
There's also cases where just driving while black.
He thought he was a police officer.
Yeah, he thought he was. So the cases of driving while black, like I myself have been harassed by cops, and gotten into arguments with them, and going to court to deal with the racial profiling and just pulling me over and accusing me of using my cell phone while driving. It was like just random things. I've been stopped and pulled over, saying, "Oh, well, you have a modified muffler. Is that an issue?" Well, there's an interesting set of excuses I've gotten for why I've been pulled over. you know. But you can't control for that, right? As a person of color, if an officer is pulling you over because they're profiling you, that's out of your control. What you can control, and where I would say that you're right in it with regards to how you respond.
Right.
You know, there are definitely tactics and ways in which, you know, folks of color should be aware of, just to make sure that you can try and prevent an officer from killing you, right? You know, and that one way is the way in which you engage them. You know, you talk to them calmly, you know, just start screaming and yelling, or, you know, and understand that that officer is an authority figure, like it or not, you know? Because if it was a black or Latino police officer that was pulling you over, they would expect you to respond to the fact that they're still in a position of authority, right? And, you know, you just can't fly off the handle and behave any kind of way, you know? While at the same time, there has to be some accountability with regards to the officer, because it is about them serving and protecting the community, not just policing and imposing on the community, and that's the way in which things tend to go generally within the country.
Well, and I'll just say, I mean, I think to Shafiq's earlier point, I think what he's talking about is, because he's a man of color, but who's also a father who's active with his kids and a police officer, he is able to, in a way that many other families are not able to, many other mentors are not able to, communicate something about life in America, life with dealing with police, that maybe you don't get, Tim, if you don't grow up in that sort of environment. And so I don't think we can just skip by that piece of it, that is something that is missing in a lot of black and brown communities across America, including right here in New Britain.
Well, the you know, the father issue, sometimes I think, I mean, all due respect, sometimes I think it distracts us from what the real issues are. You know, we need to talk about the retrenchment of state support in these communities that's happened over the last 30 years. I mean, where is the investment in education and in housing and in community and in jobs? And those are the things that are necessary in order for families to be healthy. It's what's necessary, in fact, for there to be marriage. I mean, if we want to ask the question, why is the marriage institution, does it no longer exist for the bottom 20% of the labor force? Well, there's your answer. I mean, we don't have healthy, viable communities because we have retrenched welfare. We have reorganized capitalism so that even when you do have jobs, you know, the kinds of jobs you have are often part-time jobs. You don't have health insurance. I mean, that's, you know, I know, you know, we need to talk to the fathers and hear their stories.
Right.
If you really want to know what this is about, rather than just jumping too quickly to father absence. Because there's a reason, and I think what the panelists are trying to say is, what's the reason for father absence?
Yes.
I mean, fathers don't just walk away because, you know, they want to just go get stoned. I mean, there's other things going on here, and so we need to ask those questions. So when I talk to fathers, for instance, just to give you one quick example.
Sorry, yeah, please. No,
just
please.
One quick example. I mean, do you know how many men are walking around $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 in child support debt, because they were locked up and child support continued to accrue while they were inside? Now they're going to walk out of prison $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in child support debt, and have to are going to try to re-enter families. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of conflict within these families. And one of the reasons we focus on the conflict rather than focusing on what is necessary in order to help stabilize families. Right? Of course there's going to be conflict. I mean, if where there's deprivation, there's conflict, right? And so we focus on, you know, the conflict between the sexes, which is real, and we should talk about that, because gender hierarchies are important, and we have to understand how they operate in all social locations, including the social location of the black and brown ghetto, but we also need to talk about it in other spaces as well, right? But we also have to talk about, you know, what's necessary in order to stabilize families. And when we do that and we look at what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years, well, I'm not so sure why we would be so surprised around what we're finding in these issues around father absence and so on.
I could just wrap up
on that one. My parents, when they came here from Poland 40 years ago, had many more opportunities than people today do. So not speaking English, not educated, they were both farmers, came over here and were able to secure, minimum wage jobs in a factory. Minimum wage back then was, you know, like $2 an hour, something like that in the mid-70s. However, the housing situation was what was much better back then because people spent, they spent maybe 8 or 9% of their total combined income on housing. How much does somebody spend on housing today compared to their income? People are spending 30 to 40% of their income, and I'm saying people that can't afford it are expected to spend that much of their income on housing.
So I think what you said speaks exactly to my point. I mean, all three of you have kind of echoed what I've said, and that is when you're one parent in the house and you're working two or three jobs or one job and you have a young son that's a teenager that you can't be home with for whatever reason because you're working, because you're trying to pay the bills, that son is somewhere, and they're not getting, no one's downloading to them the information that they need. I'm not putting fault on anybody. These are just facts. And then that son is exposed to society on whatever level they're exposed to because there's no buffer there. And my only point is this facts, is because in African-American families, which mostly are single-parent mothers, most of those families live below the poverty level. Those are facts. And in those families, often those children struggle to finish high school, especially the boys. And if they don't finish high school, according to a Columbia study, they are likely to get incarcerated. For whatever they get incarcerated for or arrested, that's not the debate. The point is it happens. That knocks them out of the job market. And by 21, if they have not finished their high school diploma, they're likely to have one or two children. So that means who's going to be there for that family? My point is this. Strong communities, which your families, our families at one time were a part of, strong communities are built by strong families. Whether those are rich single families or hardworking two-parent families.
And Shafiq, I'm gonna jump in just because I want to get to some of the questions here, and some people might want to have some thoughts about what you just said. Hi, what's your name?
I'm Austin. But my question was directed towards white privilege, and if there was any way that us or our generation that are in college now, if there's a way to maybe get past white privilege and make it something that's not as relevant.
Thanksgiving is coming.
I think you have to have those conversations. I think, for me, as a white woman, I work in an insurance company. I live in New Britain, so I know everybody's probably looking out there. What do you know about being black or brown? You don't look like you would. Well, you can't tell from me now, but I belong to a gang. I did drugs. I sold drugs. I was out on the streets. I was a teen mom. So I've been there. I walked in those shoes, so I understand what it is. And I thank God that that happened to me. Because if it didn't happen to me, I wouldn't know. I'd be probably sitting where you're sitting, listening to maybe somebody talking about police in the black community. But because of the fact that I got to go through those experiences and understand what it is to be in poverty, understand what it is to be black by association, okay, and understand that racism is real and it's alive. I escaped from being a statistic, a white statistic, because I was white. So I had an arrest record. Yeah, right. I created all these issues and problems for myself, but the system still treated me different because if I were black or Puerto Rican, I definitely would have been incarcerated. My situation would have been worse. And at that point, I might have been just said, screw it. I'm not even going to bother getting my life together, going through depression, maybe more drug use, et cetera, et cetera. But I firmly believe because I was white, I got rehabilitated, or those services of rehabilitation offered to me and took advantage of them and then was able to rehabilitate my life.
Tim, quickly, as I want to get to this gentleman too. Go ahead.
Race is a structural identity It's a, you said we've been around 286 years. Well, that privilege has existed for 286 years. It's a structural identity. It is part of capitalism and white supremacy. And so what we need to do is we need to work together in solidarity to change that structure. In other words, we can't just do it sitting around and saying, well, you know, we have privilege. How can we give privilege to underprivileged people? No, we have to work together to change the structure that has created that structural identity, that has created that hierarchy of privilege and underprivilege.
That's Case Western Reserve University sociology professor Tim Black. You're listening to a panel discussion on policing the black community, sponsored by the Center for Africana Studies at Central Connecticut State University. Our other panelists were community activist Agnes Kurzina, Roderick Anderson, who is a PhD candidate in anthropology at UMass Amherst and a New Britain native, and author and police officer Shafiq Abdusaber. We're also joined by Larice Harvey, Director of Strategic Relations at A Better Way Foundation. There's more after this break. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the show, we're listening back to a panel discussion we hosted at Central Connecticut State University called Policing the Black Community. Our panelists were Case Western Reserve University sociology professor Tim Black, community activist Agnes Kurzina, Roderick Anderson, who's a PhD candidate in anthropology at UMass Amherst, author and police officer Shafiq Abdusaber, and Larice Harvey, director of strategic relations at A Better Way Foundation. Here's a question from audience member Kenny Jackson.
I'm coming from Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I got over 14 years in the prison system. And myself, I was just a sperm donor. Okay, I didn't respect fatherhood until I got out of prison, when I turned my life around. So a number of flaws that's going on with a number of our young African-American and Hispanic males is the absentee father. I'm not giving an excuse. I deal with it each and every day. The parents, they pacify their kids and they buy them the things that they shouldn't be having. And the reason why I mentioned police mentorship, because I'm on both sides, so to speak. So now I get a different point of view. Before, when I was in my gangsterism stage, my disrespecting the law stage, I had tunnel vision. So now I got a balance, okay, because I have my own mentoring organization. Now the city of Bridgeport, they look to me to do police training for new recruits that's coming in. And one of the questions I ask, have any of you ever been a mentor before? Okay, and this is 99.9% white recruits. None of them have. And I'm not saying it's the fit all, but they need to be introduced into the community that they're going to be serving before they get sworn in.
We've got another question over here. As I walk over, Roderick, I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing, because I think it's an important part of the conversation. You study the role of some of the traditional organizations like the NAACP that have been around for a very long time and in many ways represent the African-American community. Some say represent the African community very well, and some say maybe not as well as it used to. Maybe you could talk a bit about that work and what you're learning.
Well, my work is on African-American civil society. I look at the role of institutions such as NAACP, Prince Hall Freemasonry, Urban League organizations such as that have been historically a part of establishing black communities, right? But I want to kind of go back to something that Tim pointed out with regards to the structural institutional pieces to which I think some of your point is actually referring to, especially with regards to the school-to-prison pipeline, as pointed out to the brother over there that just sat down. There is a structural piece that's here with regards to, well, how did these parents or fathers end up in the prison system? It wasn't just because they didn't have anyone there to look out for them when they were younger or what have you, right? You know, the system itself is set up to be biased towards a lot of folks of color in the communities, right? And that's speaking to some of the earlier conversation with regards to how these structural white supremacy is a part and partial to the overall system that we're actually living in, the historical moment that we're living in, right? This world historical moment, right? We can't just ignore the fact that if a young black person or Latino person, you know, are disproportionately targeted by law enforcement and end up having drugs planted on them, being harassed constantly, you know, that affects the way in which they then interact with one another in a community. Right, you get folks put into the system, they get out, they can't get a job because they have a prison record. All these little pieces affect the way in which parents or fathers can and can't be in a home, right? So it's this institutional aspect in there that we need to also be considering, not just the fact that, you know, black men aren't in the house, right? They're not there taking care of their kids. That's a very easy way of missing the deeper structural institutional aspects of actually what's going on in society. So with regards to my work and research, you know, that's why I just want to engage those broader questions, because if we don't actually engage what institutions are doing within the communities, right, and what their historic roles have been, you know, we're not going to understand how to get out of it.
Go ahead, Tim.
Of course, we need more personal responsibility. Of course, we want personal transformation that was spoken about earlier. I'm in a prison right now, working with fathers. You know, we are working on that, creating this space for reflection. We are working on personal and I know a number of these men who reminded me of what your comment was earlier. I mean, they're changing their lives, but you know what? They're still going to come out $20,000, $30,000 in debt and child support. They're still going to come out in communities that don't support their children. They're still going to come out in crumbling educational systems. They're still going to come out being criminalized as black men and black boys and black men in their communities and in this country. So, but point is we need volunteers. We need this work towards personal transformation. But ultimately, it's a political problem. And you need a political solution for a political problem. So if the question is, what are we going to do? We have to address this as a political issue and a political problem.
Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Nick. You guys were talking before about the rotating door of the prison system and young men of color coming out of these prisons with lots of debt. So obviously you think it's harder for young men of color to get out of this system, as you were talking about getting out of the system yourself. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on the main causes of that vicious cycle, of it being harder for young men of color to break out of that vicious cycle, and your thoughts on how we can change those causes.
I'll speak to that because that's what I do for a living, right? So you want to know what can be done, how do you do this and that and everything, and everybody asks the same question, and my response is the same thing. It is get active, get active, get active. Don't just say, hey, what do I do? And then sit and go, well, when I got time, I'll do it. No, do it now. Do it today. Take out your laptop. Take out your phones. Find out who's your legislator. Tell them you want to reform Connecticut's prison system now, not yesterday, not tomorrow, right now, this moment, this time. Their home phone numbers is on websites with their names because it's public information. But call them at home. Leave
Therese,
them a
you
message.
And I have talked about this, though, before. So here's the problem is you're asking people who have no time, who maybe
you
are
got a
over,
cell phone you, right
no,
now.
But that's an important piece of this. I mean, it's that ability to go to City Hall, to go to the Capitol. It's hard for people who have three jobs.
I would disagree with that, because if you take 15 minutes to research the latest game you want to get, you spend all night long sitting outside for some daggone sneakers, but you won't meet me at the Capitol to talk to the legislator about your life and your life situation where you can actually have your voice and change that. That's a problem.
And you
it's
don't have to go to the Capitol.
Problem.
You can send an
you
email,
can do
like
it
you
right
said.
Now. You can send an email, a text message,
a
call
phone call.
House. In Connecticut alone, approximately 350,000 people have a criminal record. That is half of a gubernatorial base that can, you know, to win a gubernatorial race. That's half of the numbers you need. So if all those people with criminal records stop feeling apathetic, and I don't necessarily know how to get them there, I'm trying to learn to do that, because We're dealing with people who have been traumatized and re-traumatized. We're dealing with people who need mental health. So why is it that when the black or the Latino boy is acting up in class, there's not a SWAT team coming in to go and say, oh, you need therapy. Let's look at their community. Let's do this and here like it happened in Newtown. God forbid, you know, that's a tragedy. But that happens every day in the hood. Every daggone day, we are losing our sons and our daughters. And I don't have no national recognition coming down to do no therapy, no counseling, no reconstruction of their education system. And we're talking about millions of dollars. For what? And I'm not bringing up Newtown as, you know, a negative. I'm saying it's a good example right here in this great state that I love and live in and work in, that we need to really reassess our own priorities.
I want to get some responses. I know we got a couple more questions and people want to. Hi, what's your name?
Crystal.
What's in your mind?
So it seems like this population is viewed at, you know, like as criminals or as lower than. And I'm talking on the ones that are kind of already in the, you know, like in jail. So what I want to know is, like, what do we do to really instill hope and a better quality of living for these men? Like, I already know that we have to, you know, look at policy and things like that. But I feel like a vision is something that a lot of these boys and men need. So instead of like going around and keep talking about what the issues are, what are we really gonna do about that?
I'll take a stab at that. I think it's a good question, because I think very often what we do is we put the change on their shoulders. You know, they're the ones who are supposed to change. They're the only ones who can have control over their lives. They're the captains of their own ship. And the truth of the matter is that they have to be able to plug into something that's larger than them. You know, as a comment was made earlier, I mean, we are just now coming to the issue of mass incarceration. You know, it's interesting. There are very few books you can point to and say that book really changed things. You know, Michael Harrington's book in 1960. I mean, Michelle Alexander's book has had a profound effect on at least galvanizing these civil rights organizations, for instance, that didn't want to have anything to do with mass incarceration. I mean, you were talking about this earlier, the NAACP, the ACLU, the Urban League. I mean, you know, it reflected a class issue within the black community that these older black civil rights organizations did not want to take up this issue of mass incarceration. Right? And the labor unions, we could also point to the labor unions in the same way. So, I mean, I will say that I think Michelle Alexander's book has been very important in putting into play a conversation and galvanizing some of these organizations. So the answer to your question is we can't expect them, if they're going to have hope, then we have to really have a decarceration movement. Think about it. I mean, most of these black men are locked up for nonviolent offenses. They don't belong in jail. Let's just say that. They do not belong in jail. And once they go into jail, they become second-class citizens. They are screwed, right? As we were saying earlier, they can't get jobs, they can't get housing, they can't get certain, they can't get Pell Grants to go to college. I mean, you know, the best they can do, you know what success looks like? I mean, if I may, you know what success looks like? I mean, I'll give you an example. So here's a guy who spent 7 years in prison. He comes out of prison. He gets involved in a culinary arts program. He becomes a star of this program, right? He gets a job. He struggles with heroin addiction, which, by the way, is a public health issue, not a criminal justice issue. It's a public health issue for most of us, but not for this population. It's a criminal justice issue for this population. So he struggles with drug addiction. He gets a job and he works for 2 years. He's making $10 an hour, working somewhere between 20 and 30 hours a week. He does this for 2 years. He has no health insurance. Essentially, he is still homeless, okay? He's 40 years old. On Friday nights, you know what he does? He sits on his father's couch and he puts earphones in his ears and listens to music. He's a 40-year-old man. And you know what we call that? Success.
That's Case Western Reserve University sociology professor Tim Black, community activist Agnes Krasina, Roderick Anderson, PhD candidate in anthropology at UMass Amherst, author and police officer Shafiq Abdusabur, and Larice Harvey, director of strategic relations at A Better Way Foundation. Thanks to the Center for Africana Studies at Central Connecticut State University for hosting the panel. Where We Live's program today was produced by executive producer Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. Thanks for joining us.